This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Hello and welcome to Encounter on ABC Radio National, where this week we're exploring virtue and virtue ethics. I'm Gary Bryson.
Goodness is connected with the attempt to see the unself, to see and to respond to the real world in the light of a virtuous consciousness, in the light of the idea of perfection. Good is a transcendent reality, means that virtue is the attempt to pierce the veil of selfish consciousness and join the world as it really is. Iris Murdoch, The Sovereignty of Good.
When we think today about the virtues, they tend to seem a little old-fashioned, ideas that have lost much of their meaning in the 21st century. But the study of virtue has a long and distinguished history. Plato identified what's become known as the four classical virtues: temperance, fortitude, justice, and prudence. And these were elaborated in greater detail still by Aristotle. Christian thinkers like St. Augustine of Hippo and St. Thomas Aquinas added the theological virtues, faith, hope, and charity, underscoring the importance of virtue in the Christian story. While the idea of virtue has languished somewhat in recent years, it now seems to be making a comeback in the form of a new virtue ethics. An appeal to virtue and to the virtuous life is re-emerging as theologians and secular philosophers try to make sense of the problems of a materialist age. As we'll see, they don't always agree. Our ideas about what's virtuous are closely tied to what we believe in. So what then is this idea we call virtue? And how can we apply our understanding of virtue and character to the ethical dilemmas of today? Well, who better to begin with than Aristotle himself, who wrote pretty much the first book on ethics? For Aristotle, ethics are all about how to live a good life. And to put it simply, to live a good life, you have to be virtuous. Stan Van Hooft is Associate Professor of Philosophy at Deakin University and the author of Understanding Virtue Ethics.
If Aristotle were to have written his book on ethics today, it would probably end up in a bookshop in the self-help section rather than in the philosophy section. It's really a book about how to live life successfully, where success means not just success in a material sense, but success in a very broad range of concerns, to live a fulfilling life, to live a life that's happy in a broad sense again, to live a life that wins the respect of others, and to live a life that's fulfilling within yourself. That's the goal, or that's the task, that ethics sets itself. And so if it answers the question, what should I do, that should is cashed out in terms of what is it advisable to do, given my goals of being successful in this broad sense, or given my goals of wanting to fulfill myself, wanting to live in harmonious relations with others. The way that the ethics is written, it seems to be a set of stages that you go through in your ethical development. First, you are trained into the virtues of character. Then you acquire practical judgment, which allows you to be successful in practical life. Then you retire and think about the eternal things. I like to think that those stages also include a feedback loop of some kind, so that the judgments you make, indeed the kind of character that you develop through your habits, are in fact informed by the theoretical wisdom, the transcendent knowledge that has been acquired perhaps by previous generations in that final stage of life.
Aristotle thought that being virtuous was essential to human happiness, not the happiness we tend to associate with material well-being, but something he called eudaimonia.
Eudaimonia, which is most often translated as happiness, is a very rich concept. The happy man, or the man of good spirit, which is what the word literally means, is a man, or a woman indeed, who has fulfilled the potentials that they have as a human being. He or she will be a person who has won the respect and admiration of their acquaintances and friends. They will have made a significant contribution to their community. If they've made it to old age, they will have acquired some wisdom and some understanding of what Aristotle called the eternal things. And they will have engaged in activities that are worthy and noble, and engaged in them successfully and with commitment.
As the soul and body are two, we see also that there are two parts of the soul, the rational and the irrational, and two corresponding states, reason and appetite. And as the body is prior in order of generation to the soul, so the irrational is prior to the rational. The proof is that anger and wishing and desire are implanted in children from their very birth, but reason and understanding are developed as they grow older. Aristotle, Nicomachean Ethics.
He speaks of four parts of the soul, and the translators characterize them as the vegetative part, the appetitive part, the calculative part, and the contemplative part. Those are big fancy words, and indeed the word part is a little misleading too. It makes it sound as if we're talking about an entity that has sections or compartments. I prefer to think in terms of ways of existing or functions of human existence. One of the things that's going on when we exist is that our biological system is functioning. That's the vegetative part. When that is working well, when we are living well at that level, so to speak, we are healthy and we're eating well and so forth, we're exercising. The appetitive part has to do with our desires and our emotions. That too is an aspect of our existence. When we are doing well at that level, we have desires that are moderate and also desires for things that are worth desiring. If we desire self-destructive things like drugs of addiction, that's a bad desire to have. And even if a desire was a good one, a desire for good food, for example, if we desired to excess, that also would be a bad thing. Not morally bad necessarily, though nowadays we do think that, but certainly bad because it would not help us in our goal of living a good and fulfilling life. Our emotions too, which Aristotle doesn't actually talk terribly much about, are the sorts of things that we should enjoy, as it were, in moderation. I mean, there are some things that might make us angry, and that's okay, provided we don't go to excess. And our affections too should be moderate, though these are very discussable matters, I should think.
Those four functions, the four parts of the soul, break down into two aspects, don't they? The desiring and the rational.
Yes, those are the two headings, certainly.
And these can be exercised well or poorly, as you say. And when we exercise them well, we display virtue. Is that the way Aristotle's thinking works?
Yeah, more or less. He says we display virtue when we act in accordance with the various standards that these functions have. So when we think intelligently in accordance with the standard that applies to that part of our existence, then we are acting virtuously.
Which particular virtues did Aristotle foreground as being important in this schema?
He spoke a fair bit about courage. He lived, of course, in a warrior society where the young aristocrats to whom he was addressing himself all spent time in military service, and they had a fair bit of work to do because it was a fairly warlike period. And so courage he understood in terms of facing the dangers of battle, and importantly he also understood it as involving doing that for the sake of a noble cause. So in defence of the city against, you know, the invading barbarians, if you faced the dangers of battle, then you were a courageous person. He specified that it should be for a noble cause because he didn't think that bank robbers were courageous because they might have been acting with bravado, let's say, but because what they were doing was not for a noble cause, it didn't count as courage. He spoke also of temperance. He had a lot to say about the way we deal with pleasure. Again, speaking for aristocrats who are wealthy, had a lot of leisure. One of the ethical problems, if you will, one of the problems that you have to deal with in order to live your life well is not to be seduced by the pleasures that are available to you. So temperance and continence were virtues that he deemed very important.
The full performance of man's function depends upon a combination of prudence and moral virtue. Virtue ensures the correctness of the end at which we aim, and prudence that of the means towards it. Aristotle, Nicomachean Ethics.
Practical wisdom, or prudence, is the virtue that pertains to the rational part of our nature.
Rosalind Hursthaus is Professor of Philosophy at the University of Auckland and the author of On Virtue Ethics.
It's one of Aristotle's great insights, I think, that just having good inclinations, that is, you know, as we would say, having a good heart and wanting to help people and wanting to be kind and wanting to be loyal and wanting to be honest, all those things, you can be like that with a good heart. But unless all of those good desires and good intentions are informed and infused by practical wisdom, you're going to put your foot in it an awful lot of the time, and sometimes, in fact, do exactly the wrong thing, despite your good intentions, in the way in which, for instance, really nice adolescents often do. Adolescents, after all, can be very good-hearted and often have very splendid ideals, but because they're still adolescents and don't have any experience of life, really, they lack practical wisdom, and so they often put their foot in it.
This is the virtue of which Aristotle says, if you have that virtue, then you needn't worry about the others too much, because in any specific situation, you'll be able to see what is called for. You'll be sensitive to the concerns that people have, the suffering that may be involved, the dangers that might be involved, the needs that other people have, and you'll understand the situation in terms of what the practical implications might be of the decision you're contemplating, and then you'll make a sound decision.
For Aristotle, then, virtue was something we could learn, and more than this, it was our responsibility to try to make ourselves virtuous, to achieve practical wisdom and the profound happiness of eudaimonia. But was there a transcendental aspect to this? Did the gods play any part in Aristotle's understanding of virtue? Stan van Hooft.
When he goes on to talk about the function of the soul that has to do with contemplation, when he starts to talk about wisdom in the sense of Sophia, he does talk about our knowledge of the gods and our knowledge of what we might call moral principles. What he's talking about there is a way of thinking about the eternal things, the things that we can't change through our actions. And he does suppose that we will learn from thinking about those things, that it will deepen our wisdom and in that way deepen our judgment. He doesn't say so, but I like to think that he would expect a person who achieves Sophia, he envisages this being an older person who's retired from practical life, so to speak, retired from being a statesman or whatever, and who discourses about these matters with his friends and so forth. But I would like to think that he would also discourse about these matters with younger people, and in that way convey some of that wisdom and pass on some of the insights that come from thinking about eternal things, whether they be the gods, moral principles or whatever, transcendent matters to use a more modern term. And if that's right, if that's a feasible interpretation of the text, then I think there is a feedback, if you will, from transcendent thinking or theological thinking, as it might be today, into the practical life.
It's a totally secular ethic. It leaves you on your own and leaves you with the responsibility. What Aristotle does insist on, and which I myself am entirely convinced is true, is that it is an objective matter of fact whether you know, doing this in these particular circumstances or what have you, is right or not. And so, given that it's subjective, it really is important that you get it right. But there's no way out. There's no further court of appeal. You can only cross your fingers and hope that you have got it right. And be prepared to suffer remorse if you subsequently realize that, no, you hadn't. One of the ways in which I think we are allowed to say, you know, we have moved on a great deal from the ancient Greeks in Western civilization. I mean, Eastern civilization had it much earlier, I think. But, of course, what Christianity added to the list of the ancient Greek virtues was charity or compassion. And it must be said, I think, it's perfectly clear that the Greeks basically didn't have it. And it was a great thing that Christianity gave to Western civilization, I think, that all-important extra virtue.
Philosophers Rosalind Hursthaus and Stan van Hooft. The ancient Greeks had pretty much the last word until the virtues came to the attention of early Christian scholars. One of the first of these was St. Augustine of Hippo, who took from Plato the idea of four central virtues, the so-called four classical virtues, temperance, fortitude, justice, and prudence.
For Augustine, all virtues, whether the virtues of prudence and temperance and fortitude that classical philosophers had talked about, or faith and hope, ultimately are rooted in charity, and are really all, for Augustine, just different forms of charity.
Thomas Williams is Associate Professor of Philosophy and Religious Studies at the University of South Florida.
Augustine is really taking the notion in certain ways from his predecessors in philosophy. I'm inclined to say his pagan predecessors, but the concept of pagan thought is, in a way, an invention of Augustine's own. But he looks at the Platonists, the Epicureans, the Stoics, and sees them all talking about virtue and happiness and finds a certain utility in those concepts, but also thinks that they are misguided in some really fundamental ways. So the virtues are important as ways of structuring our actions towards our ultimate goal, which, as he agrees with almost everyone before him, is happiness. And so the virtues are dispositions by which we come closer to happiness. But as a Christian, he has a very different conception of what happiness comes to. And as a result, his conception of the virtues will also be radically different.
In contrast to Aristotle's notion of happiness achieved through right action, Augustine believed that there could be no happiness without love of God. This allowed him to redefine the four classical virtues and to give them a theological spin.
What we see in Augustine's appropriation of that is really a reduction or a sort of identification, you might almost say, of those four virtues with charity or love of God. So that temperance, for example, we classically think of temperance as the virtue that enables us to deal in a right way with the pleasures of food, drink, and sex, for example. Augustine says temperance is love rejecting those things that would draw us away from what ought to be loved. Similarly, bravery or fortitude or courage would be love holding steadfastly to that which it loves in the face of difficulty. So we explain or understand those four classical virtues always in terms of love of God.
On this encounter on ABC Radio National, we're discussing the virtues in philosophy and in theology. For Augustine, virtue was a gift of God. What was played down in his account was Aristotle's notion that virtues can be learned, and that we can actively improve ourselves and our behaviour. This was brought back into the equation several hundred years later by that remarkable Christian theologian, Thomas Aquinas.
For a man to do a good deed, it is requisite not only that his reason be well disposed by means of a habit of intellectual virtue, but also that his appetite be well disposed by means of a habit of moral virtue. And so moral differs from intellectual virtue, even as the appetite differs from the reason. Thomas Aquinas, Summa Theologica.
Aquinas sees in Aristotle a very attractive and full and well-articulated picture of a kind of happiness that we can attain by our own resources and that really, for Aquinas, deserves the name of happiness. And this is where Aquinas and Augustine are going to differ. Augustine thinks that in this life, there's nothing we can attain by our own doing or even by gift of God that really deserves the name of happiness. Not so for Aquinas. He sees in Aristotle a picture of the virtuous life that really deserves to be called happiness. Why? Because it is a fulfillment of the powers that are natural to us and definitive of us as human beings. So Aristotle's picture of happiness is attractive, and it shows human beings fulfilled according to their natural abilities. What Aquinas then adds to that is this picture that for Christians, there's not just the natural fulfillment of human beings, there's also a supernatural fulfillment. Aristotle, of course, didn't know anything about this, Aquinas says, but what Aristotle did know about gets to count as happiness. Aquinas will call it imperfect or incomplete happiness. And there are virtues that will dispose us to attaining Aristotelian natural happiness, but there also need to be virtues that dispose us to attaining the supernatural happiness that Aristotle didn't know anything about, and which is our ultimate end, our ultimate goal for Aquinas. It's a brilliant way of accommodating everything that he saw was worth saving in Augustine, as well as in Aristotle, and putting it together to make a coherent whole, so that we can save the notion from Augustine that God is calling people to something higher than they can attain by their own natural powers, without denigrating those natural powers. And I think from Aquinas' point of view, Augustine is inclined to minimize the dignity that belongs to human beings just as human beings.
Aquinas reordered the virtues into three categories: the moral, the intellectual, and the theological. The moral virtues were justice, temperance, and fortitude.
Justice is what regulates the will, which is our intellectual appetite, that is, our desire for what the intellect reveals to us, or at least presents to us, as good. The other two virtues, temperance and fortitude, have to deal with the appetite that we have in common with animals. So it enables us to deal well with those things in our life that the senses reveal to us as good or as worth fighting for example, in the presence of danger.
And this is really drawing from Aristotle at this point, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the basic classification is very, very similar. The biggest difference, I think, is that Aquinas is much more rigorous than Aristotle is about always tying in the specific virtue to the notion of happiness and to our ultimate good. Aristotle lets that kind of sit a little bit loosely. For Aquinas, there's always a very clear connection. We need a particular virtue for a particular reason in order to enable us to attain happiness, and that connection always gets drawn very explicitly.
So what then were the intellectual virtues in Aquinas' categorization?
Well, there's one particularly tricky one, which is the virtue of prudence, or as a lot of people prefer to translate it, practical wisdom. It's an intellectual virtue in the sense that it enables us to think well and readily about how we ought to act. It's the virtue by which we apply our sort of general knowledge of how to act to the specific situations that we encounter. Because it's a virtue of thinking, it's an intellectual virtue. But because it's hooked up with our action in the world, it in a way is counted with the moral virtues as well. There are other intellectual virtues that don't have to do with thinking for the sake of action, but with thinking for the sake of thinking, such virtues as what he calls science or knowledge, the virtues that deal with excellence in knowing the things that don't have any practical application, at least in any obvious way.
And as you say, can be acquired by learning.
Yes, absolutely, can be acquired by learning. The moral virtues are acquired by habituation or practice. I become courageous by responding in certain ways when I'm faced with difficult situations, for example. I acquire the virtue of knowledge by learning and study and being taught. What distinguishes the moral and intellectual virtues from the theological is that I acquire the theological virtues by the gift of God.
The theological virtues, says Aquinas, are those familiar old friends, faith, hope, and charity.
The theological virtues are the virtues that we need because we are not citizens of an earthly country or city, but because we are, as St. Paul says, fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God. That's a different and a higher calling, and requires different and higher virtues, virtues that really lie beyond our powers of attainment. So if we're going to have them at all, we have to have them as a gift of God.
So for Aquinas, the moral virtues were learned, the intellectual and theological virtues came from God. But just to complicate matters a bit further, Aquinas argued that moral virtues could also be a gift from God. These he called the infused moral virtues.
We really have two brands of moral virtues. There are the moral virtues that we attain in the way Aristotle talks about, just by practice and habituation, and in the same way that we acquire the skill of playing the piano well or of being a good tennis player, we work at it. There are also, he says, these infused, literally poured in, moral virtues. They're the same virtues by name, so there's infused courage just as there is acquired courage, but they're obtained by a gift of God. The difference, though, is not only in their acquisition, it's also in what they enable us to do. Again, as I've said, Aquinas is very careful always to tie these in with happiness. When you're talking about the acquired moral virtues, so let's say acquired courage. If I have acquired the virtue of courage, that enables me to deal well with dangerous situations in order to obtain natural happiness. If God has given me infused courage, the stuff I'm dealing with is still the same, dangerous situations, but the reason for which I'm dealing with it is different. It's now concerning my supernatural happiness rather than my natural happiness.
Thomas Williams from the University of South Florida. In the years following Aquinas, virtue largely became a part of folk wisdom, the stuff of bracing aphorisms and instructive proverbs. The Enlightenment philosopher David Hume paid it some attention, as did the 19th century philosopher Immanuel Kant. But it's not until recent years that virtue has again come under philosophical and theological scrutiny. It resurfaced around the mid-1990s in the form of a new ethics, virtue ethics. University of Auckland philosopher Rosalind Hursthouse is one of its foremost exponents.
Virtue ethics is this particular approach to the kinds of questions with which moral philosophy is concerned, let us say, which is a broad brief, that takes virtue as its central concept. So you begin with your thoughts about the various character traits that we take the virtues to be, like courage and justice and temperance and kindness and honesty, loyalty, a whole lot of things like that. And you think about various issues in ethics in those terms. So most particularly, when you're thinking about what you ought to do, rather than looking for some kind of rule like do not kill or what have you, I mean, there's nothing particularly wrong with going to that rule, but it's not terribly specific, really, when you think of it. You ask yourself, just quite straightforwardly, well, what would a virtuous agent, that is somebody who really is admirable in courage or loyalty or generosity or kindness and so on, what would they do in these circumstances in which I find myself? And because, after all, we all have thoughts about what's involved in courage and what's involved in honesty and so on and so forth, very often that really gives us a very specific direction. It not only tells you what to do, it also tells you the way in which you've got to do it. And that's sort of what's characteristic about the virtue ethics approach, that it doesn't try and just apply rules to various situations and churn out a result that says, oh, well, if I've kept the rule, then I've done what's right and that's all I have to worry about. It makes you think about it for yourself in terms of your understanding of the virtue terms. And through your understanding of those, you usually get quite a firm direction about the way in which the action has to be done.
Virtue ethics, then, is an alternative to other modes of ethical decision-making, which are usually either utilitarian, designed to elicit the greatest good for the greatest number, or a form of command ethics based on rules, including religious injunctions and secular laws.
Take a very simple example where, you know, the correspondence with the rule is going to be quite close. There's a question about whether or not I should tell someone a truth which is going to hurt them. And there, it looks as though going to the rules isn't a terribly helpful thing to do, because on the one hand, we're going to say, well, we've got a rule that says don't lie. And on the other hand, we've got a rule that says don't hurt people. And exactly why I'm not quite sure what to do is because I seem caught between the two poles. Am I going to lie or am I going to hurt them? What shall I do? Well, if one immediately just starts thinking in terms of the virtues of honesty and kindness, most people can figure out quite quickly that though honesty certainly forbids barefaced lies, it doesn't require that you always tell unpleasant truths. But then also when we think of kindness, we realize that, as the phrase goes, sometimes one has to be cruel to be kind. And so there are some sorts of truths that you have to tell people, even though you are going to hurt them, because you're doing them no kindness by concealing the truth from them.
We're reconceptualizing what morality is. What we've been taught, certainly since Kant, is that morality is a system of principles which tell us what our obligations are and what we are prohibited from doing. It's always had a little bit of trouble, that system of thought, with what are known in the technical jargon as supererogatory actions, that is to say, actions which are not demanded of us by duty, but which are nevertheless good to do. And that shows that the morality system is more or less confined to right and wrong, whereas virtue ethics conceives of ethics much more broadly. Certainly it conceives of the things that it is good to do, but it embraces things that aren't perhaps especially moral at all, like, for example, being punctual. That's not usually a moral issue, and yet it is something that conduces to the way that one lives and to the harmony with which one lives with others. And so in that sense, being punctual is a virtue. And so it broadens out what can be considered under the broad heading of how one should live one's life.
I and you are each the only people who can make ourselves virtuous. It's not anything that anybody else can do for us. We have to cultivate the virtues in ourselves, and it requires our own individual effort and our own individual personal thought and direction. But regardless of our different cultures, since we are all human beings and we have the same sort of basic needs and we're the same sort of animal, we do need the very same sort of caricatures.
Rosalind Hursthaus and Stan van Hooft.
Aquinas argued that what temperance, courage, practical reason and justice mean for Christians could be quite different than what they mean for other people.
Stanley Harwas is Gilbert T. Rowe Professor of Theological Ethics at Duke Divinity School and a leading Christian ethicist, one of the first to reclaim virtue as part of an ethical system. The issue of whether virtues are universal or whether they're particular to different cultures and religions is one that concerns virtue ethicists today.
Take the issue of courage. For Aristotle, of course, the paradigmatic form of courage was in battle, because you had to contemplate your death prior to the battle. That was very important for Aristotle. For Aquinas, who certainly thought that courage in battle was a significant exemplification of courage, the primary paradigm of courage as a virtue was the martyr, who knew how to endure patiently the violence against the self.
As a Christian ethicist, Stanley Harwas believes that an ethics based on the virtues can only make sense in a Christian context.
The language of virtues Christians have always found extremely useful for the articulation of what it means to live as a Christian. But of course, the language of discipleship is biblically much more determinative for how we think of the nature of our lives. And that means that you can't have an ethic of the virtues separated from your understanding of Jesus. That has been a temptation by Christians, to separate the language of the virtues from how we understand what it means to be a follower of Christ.
What in particular characterizes a Christian virtue ethics, or what should characterize a Christian virtue ethics as opposed to a secular virtue ethics? What are the important virtues?
Patience and hope, I think, are oftentimes virtues that fail to be individuated and named in more secular context. Christians are a people who are made hopeful by what we believe has been done for us in Jesus Christ, asking us to have the desire for what God has done for us to be true for all people. So we long for justice, but Christian hope demands a correlative patience that comes from the fact that we know it is not our task, but God's, to make the world just. Our task is faithfulness in the light of what we believe has been done in Christ, which makes it possible for us to be patient. So the virtue of patience is constitutive of the character of what it means to be a disciple of Christ.
Virtue and the Virtues is the subject of this encounter on ABC Radio National. And in particular, we're exploring virtue ethics, an approach that appeals to our personal virtues in making ethical decisions. Virtue ethics has been taken up by both secular and Christian thinkers, though the difference is more than just one of emphasis. Stan van Hooft.
A Christian ethicist, a virtue ethicist, would perhaps bring in further virtues such as faith and love, in the sense of love of God. But it would seem to me, and I stand to be corrected on this, that ultimately the presence of God, so to speak, on the horizon of one's considering the issues, and indeed of one's feelings and stances and attitudes in relation to the issues, does turn the matter into a moral matter, takes it out of the realm of virtue, pure and simple, and brings it into the realm of morality, because God is, after all, the commander and the judge. And he does issue the law. And so as soon as God comes into the picture, the way in which one lives in that situation alters, and it alters in such a way that one becomes obedient. And if that's the psychological stance you're taking, then you're no longer, in my view, taking a purely virtue ethics stance.
Obedience is a virtue as part of the necessity of acknowledging that we only become virtuous through being made apprentices to a master. So oftentimes, in order to acquire the virtues, I must do what the master tells me to do, even though I do not understand why it is that I need to do it this way.
People sometimes think, I suppose, because of its particularism and its, oh, well, things change according to circumstances kind of line, that there's something kind of rather soft about virtue ethics, that it'll never land you in a hot spot. And that's just absolutely not so. I mean, the virtues and the vices do land you in a hot spot every time. Courage is the paradigm one, right? Because courage is often going to say, yeah, look, what courage demands that you lay down your life. That's what it demands. This is a requirement. But in the same way, charity will do that when it's a matter of we're right down to there's enough food to sustain one of us, but not both of us. Charity requires that if I'm the one who's got the food, I share it or I give it up. And I die, perhaps. But that's what it requires, no doubt about it.
Whether you take a Christian approach or a secular one, virtue ethics allows us to make decisions on how to act based on doing what we think is right. That is, what we ourselves think is most virtuous. The approach doesn't make ethical decision-making any easier, but because we can learn to be virtuous, say its proponents, it allows for the possibility of a virtue ethos, a society in which, more often than not, the right action will be taken. So what happens when you apply virtue ethics to real-life ethical issues? For example, whether we should allow the development of embryonic stem cell research. This is an issue which is not only about personal belief, but about public policy making. Can virtue help us through it? Sylvia Dean Drummond is a former scientist, now professor in theology and the biological sciences at the University of Chester, and the author of Genetics and Christian Ethics. For her, the overriding ethic to apply to the area of genetics is that of prudence.
One of the particular reasons why prudence is helpful in this context is the different dimensions of prudence. For example, memory would remind people to remember the horrors of the eugenic era and not to follow that sort of pattern of discrimination. Genetics has had a very poor history in that sense, but at that time it was considered a good. So it's a distortion of the good in the name of a narrow form of good. And that's what prudence tries to show up. It tries to show up distortions of the good. Teachableness is another area which I think is important dimension of prudence, in that it allows people to listen to maybe different sides of the argument, different aspects of the debate about, say, the status of the embryo and so on, without labelling one side or other as being appallingly wrong. Reasoned judgment, again, is so it's not an irrational response to what is available. Circumspection is about actually being able to have insights into what is possible according to the science. I think sometimes ethical discussion in genetics has not paid sufficient attention to the scientific aspects, that we can't actually ignore what is feasible and possible in the science, but we can perhaps try and see another dimension of prudence, which is foresight, what might be the consequences of behaving in a particular sort of way. So it's wrong to say that virtue ethics understood in terms of prudence doesn't have any consequences in mind. It does, in the dimension of foresight. And it, of course, it also has the element of insight, which is knowing what the truth might be in a given situation.
Well, when we look at an issue like, for example, stem cell research, which we're debating in this country at the moment, what virtues do you think are relevant for us in order to consider these questions and to remain virtuous agents, as it were, in the making of public policy?
One of the important things is to be genuine about representation of different groups. In other words, teachableness, which is an aspect of prudence, would be open to learning from hearing different voices in the debate. For example, those with disabilities that perhaps would feel excluded by certain techniques such as pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. When you come to the stem cell debate, I think that in this case we're forced into discussions about the status of the embryo, but to try and avoid that becoming too fractious, I think it would take the virtue of insight and acumen and reasoned judgment in the light of the different possibilities, rather than letting it become a very polarised debate that just leads to so much hostility really on all sides.
Stem cell research is a very interesting and difficult issue. One of the things that I think virtue ethics does, not all virtue ethicists will agree with me on this, I don't think, but I think that virtue ethics does allow us to make a relatively clear distinction between personal decision making in the ethical sphere and public policy issues. Virtue ethics is most at home at the personal level. So if we were talking about stem cell research, we, in order to make it real, so to speak, from a virtue ethics point of view, we'd have to talk about a stem cell researcher and what he or she brings to their research and how they approach it. If they were dealing with embryonic stem cells, we would expect that they would show a great deal of respect and deference. They may indeed decide that it's not appropriate to engage in such research at all. Other people might decide otherwise, but either way, they would be sensitive to the fact that this is precious material.
Stan Van Hooft and Sylvia Dean Drummond. We could perhaps imagine another situation where an individual has to make a decision about the stem cell issue. For example, a terminally ill patient who's told they can be cured by a procedure that's been developed through research which has itself involved the destruction of human embryos. What should that person do to remain virtuous? Rosalind Hursthaus?
Well, it does depend on what they believe themselves. Because if they believe that the stem cell research was wrong, of course they mustn't take advantage of it. I mean, that would be dishonest and hypocritical and lacking in integrity. So, for instance, when I think of my great mentor and undoubtedly the greatest philosopher I've ever known in my life, Elizabeth Anscombe, I know perfectly well of Elizabeth Anscombe that she would have far rather died than had her life lengthened in such a way, because she would certainly have believed that stem cell research was wrong, and she wouldn't have touched it with a barge pole. And regardless of whether or not I agree with her about that, I'd say, right, that's virtue. Because your virtue doesn't consist in your particular beliefs. They depend on what you do with them.
You can't really avoid the status of embryo questions here. And I think that in that sense, if that individual believed that in destroying an embryo they were destroying a person, then it would show a lack of virtue for them to go ahead. If, on the other hand, they did not believe that, then the possibility would be open for them to follow that route. Those who genuinely believe that life starts from the moment of conception would have to show fortitude in resisting it, to be honest, because I don't think they could express virtue if they held that particular belief. So I think they'd have to show some integrity in that sense. But on the other hand, if someone had a more liberal position, then it would be possible to be virtuous and allow some form of treatment to take place. We'd also have to take into account, well, who else was going to benefit from this technology? Was it going to make, you know, a lot of money for other companies and so on? And what the real risk was to that individual, because very often these experimental technologies will be given a certain gloss which would avoid the risks that could be associated with that technology. But if you're in a life and death situation, it may be that they would believe that the risk was worth taking.
If the members of your family are divided, for instance, about whether you should go ahead or not, then that ought to be something you take seriously. If the duty of family loyalty within your culture requires that you defer to the members of your family, then if you're all for going ahead and all of them say, no, you shouldn't, then I think for sure you should defer, because it's part of the virtue of loyalty in the circumstances that you are in that you do defer.
Rosalind Hursthaus and Celia Dean Drummond. In any discussion of virtue ethics, it seems that our personal beliefs are going to have a big impact on which virtues are important and how we understand them. And while the virtues can usefully guide us in our personal decision-making, in the public realm they're still very much contested territory. So final thoughts from Stan Van Hooft.
The virtue that becomes relevant is the civic virtue of engaging in public debates in the appropriate terms for a liberal society. We don't live in a theocratic society. We don't live in a society ruled by divine law. And so the virtuous stance for anyone, irrespective of their theological commitments to take, is to enter into public debate in the spirit, so to speak, that is appropriate to a liberal society. In other words, discuss the issues in terms of the social good.
And readings for today's programme were by Julie Browning, Andrew McLennan and David Rutledge. Technical production, Charlie McCune and Luke Purse. I'm Gary Bryson, and Counter will be back same time next week.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.